Thank you very much, Bill. Just the briefest of personal notes. It was almost 30 years ago that I heard for the first time on WFCR radio in Amherst, Massachusetts, the singing of Roland Hayes. And I carry in my briefcase an Apple iPod. And I have two of my favorite CDs as MP3s on that iPod of the music of Roland Hayes. And it's an unexpected and completely unusual pleasure for me, 30 years after I first heard of him, to be giving a lecture in an auditorium named after him. Thank you for having me. Though the lecture you are about to hear does not contain a single reference to the work of C.S. Lewis, I've written it as I write everything with a challenging example of Lewis in mind. In the evangelical Protestant world where I work, the example of Lewis can be a daunting one. To some, to care about Lewis is to try to continue, some 40 years after his death, to think his thoughts after him. In some cases, this impulse results in instructive attempts to imagine how Lewis would interact with contemporary intellectual theories or cultural practices. But in too many instances, such efforts end up as awkward forms of a WWLT syndrome. What would Lewis think? Instead of trying to divine what Lewis would have thought, we would do well to follow the example of how he thought. Rather than trying to think his thoughts after him, that is, we most fully honor Lewis when we seek to emulate his superb example of theological and cultural engagement. Lewis took the truths of the Christian scriptures, the Christian tradition, and Christian experience as he understood them, and he sought to apply them to the myriad ideas and forces he encountered in his world. Whether it was the current state of affairs in the study of late medieval literature, the future of modern science in general, and space travel in particular, the experience of English children at mid-century, or the ongoing struggles of the Anglican Church, Lewis thought hard about the perils and the possibilities of his age. And he did so in the most lucid and graceful English prose of his generation. It is a challenging task to imitate such an example, but it is also an ennobling one. Let us try. And let us keep on trying. Nimble believing, modern literature, and the conflict of interpretations. Brokenhearted and largely bereft of the hope that had driven him through a decade of frantic, brilliant novel writing, Herman Melville sailed from New York on October 11, 1856. With a number of intermediate stops before him, the 37-year-old novelist had as his ultimate destination the Eastern Mediterranean and the Holy Lands. Exhausted by the never-ending clash of ideas within himself, Melville sought rest in his journey and something more, perhaps a sign of the divine presence or an assurance of the divine favor in the desolate landscape where Judaism and Christianity had been born. Impoverished as he was, Melville had to rely upon a sizable advance from his father-in-law, the famed Judge Lemuel Shaw of the Massachusetts Supreme Court, to fund this trip. Shaw was willing to pay because he recognized the precarious state of his son-in-law's emotional and spiritual health. "I suppose you have been informed," Shaw wrote to his own son, "how very ill Herman has been." In a series of letters, Shaw's daughter had told her father of her great anxiety about her husband's health. When Herman's deeply engaged in one of his literary works, he confines himself to many hard hours in his study every day with little or no exercise. This overwork, quote, brings on severe nervous affections, and the proposed trip, Shaw said of his son-in-law, would bring just the change Melville needed and would be highly beneficial to him and probably restore him. As generous and as well-intentioned as he was in his treatment of his wayward son-in-law, Lemuel Shaw did not really understand Herman's spiritual malaise any better than loyal Starbuck can comprehend the internal agonies of tormented Captain Ahab in Melville's greatest novel, Moby Dick. Where Shaw thought exercise and a change of scenery might cure Herman's ills, Starbuck believes his captain needs to look on the practical side of things and the sunny side of life, and all will be well. Yet for Ahab, the problem goes far deeper than a simple case of dispositional change. He piled upon the whale's white hump the sum of all the general rage and hate felt in his whole race from Adam down. And then, as if his chest had been a mortar, he burst his hot heart's shell upon it. That's Ishmael's report on Ahab's state. To Starbuck, Ahab later confesses, "I feel deadly faint, bowed and humped, as though I were Adam, staggering beneath the piled centuries since paradise." Ahab begs Starbuck to stand close to me. "Let me look into a human eye. It is better than to gaze upon sea or sky, better than to gaze upon God." Ahab's agony cuts deep, as did Melville's spiritual disquiet at the time that he sailed for Europe in 1856. On the way to the Mediterranean, he stopped in the British Isles to do some casual research into his ancestral roots and to visit his friend and fellow novelist, Nathaniel Hawthorne, who was serving a political appointment at the United States Consulate in Liverpool. On November 12th, they took a long walk on a desolate beach on the Irish Sea. After this walk, Hawthorne wrote his famous description of the younger friend's spiritual torment. And in an extended journal entry, Hawthorne described how Melville had launched into a discussion, as he always does, of providence and futurity, and of everything that lies beyond human ken. No longer able to believe with any confidence in a doctrine of personal immortality, Melville informed his friend Hawthorne that, quote, he had pretty much made up his mind to be annihilated. Well, when you think about it, that's kind of an interesting choice to decide upon, as though he really had a say in the matter. But Melville was a determined man, and he told Hawthorne, "If I can't know whether there's a heaven or a hell, I am going to choose to be annihilated." Hawthorne didn't believe it for a minute. Despite the bravado of this resolution, Melville seemed nervously uncertain about his own beliefs and his own future. Hawthorne noted that he could not seem to rest in that anticipation of annihilation. Well, who can blame him? And he surmised that he will, quote, never rest until he gets hold of a definite belief. To the older man, it is amazing how the younger companion persists in his wandering to and fro over these deserts, as dismal and monotonous as the sand hills amid which we were sitting. In almost every respect, Melville's life seemed like an endless round of motion, without pattern or without destination. His mind a wearisome to and froing of energy without a goal. He can neither believe nor be comfortable in his unbelief, Hawthorne concluded. And he is too honest and too courageous not to try to do one or the other. Melville's questing uncertainty bears many resemblances to the experience of his great contemporary, Emily Dickinson. Dickinson, like Melville, seemed torn between the will's longing to believe and the mind's skepticism about belief. Many of her 1,700-plus poems assume radically opposing stances on the question of belief. And taken together, they give a picture of Dickinson as one who can also neither believe nor be comfortable in her own unbelief. Late in life, less than 4 years before she died, she wrote in a letter to an intimate friend. This is, by the way, the only man she ever really thought of marrying, and it's really, that's one of the fascinating stories of Emily Dickinson. I can't get into it much, just to say that she fell passionately in love at the age of 50 with a 70-year-old widower, and he pressed the case as hard as a human being can press the case, and she kept saying no. She told him at one point, "No is the wildest word we consign to language. Don't you know that you're happiest when I withhold and do not confer?" Well, this man was frustrated. And he got many intimate personal letters from Emily, and in typical Dickinson fashion, in one of these letters, in one sense, apropos of nothing, out of the blue, she writes this. On subjects of which we know nothing, or should I say beings, we both believe and disbelieve 100 times an hour, which keeps believing nimble. With her image of nimble believing, Dickinson described an experience that I believe is unique to the modern world and traceable to cultural developments in 19th century Europe and North America. This experience involved the discovery of the possibility of an openly avowed unbelief. In the middle decades of the 19th century, in James Turner's words, this settled inability to accept the reality of God, rather than positive atheism, became the distinctly modern unbelief. In their studies of modern unbelief, Turner, Charles Taylor, and others have argued that in the late 19th century, settled belief in God came to seem, for the first time in Western history, an optional affair, a matter of choice and self-definition and self-determination. Now, at first glance, the shift that Turner claims to have discovered in the 19th century may appear to represent little more than a modern revival of an ancient denial. The Psalms and wisdom literature of the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, for example, speak of those, quote, fools who say in their hearts there is no God. And from the ancient worlds, the likes of Epicurus and Lucretius appear to depict a godless universe of material processes and material pleasures. In each of these instances, however, it is not the existence of God so much, but the providence of God that is denied. In annotating Psalm 14's assertion, fools say in their hearts, there is no God, John Selman notes, the fool denies not God's existence, but divine governance of the world in attention to humankind. It is only in the latter half of the 19th century that settled unbelief, a settled lack of belief in the existence of God, became a widespread and publicly viable option. In many narratives written from the 19th century to the present, the rise of this unbelief appears as a sign of irreversible development and unmistakable gain. A variation of this argument stands behind the development of the modern social sciences and the flowering of many aspects of the political and cultural ideals of liberal individualism. Yet at the same time, in other accounts, which are as diverse as religious fundamentalism's reading of modernity and literary modernism's reading of 19th century optimism, in other accounts, the rise of unbelief registers as a calamity of loss. But whether they consider the loss of belief to have been a blessing or a bane, most accounts of the battle between modernist advances and fundamentalist reactions viewed belief and unbelief as opposing forces clashing on the battle-scarred landscape of modernity. In the literature of the 19th century, as well as in the criticism of the 20th, assumptions of this nature have largely governed the writing of literary history. The powerful appeal of this cultural narrative is evident in the work of M.H. Abrams, for example. The great scholar whose The Mirror and the Lamp and Natural Supernaturalism are surely two of the most influential works of literary history from the second half of the 20th century. In the preface to Natural Supernaturalism, Abrams establishes the narrative framework. It is a historical commonplace, he explains, that the course of Western thought since the Renaissance has been one of progressive secularization. That is not to say that secular thinkers were able, quote, to work free of the centuries-old Judeo-Christian culture. Instead of deleting and replacing religious ideas, Abrams argues, modern poets and novelists have assimilated them and reinterpreted those, quote, religious ideas as constitutive elements in a worldview founded on secular premises. Taking the loss of religious belief and the rise of unbelief as givens, writers in the Romantic tradition, in Abrams' memorable formulation, strove to, quote, save traditional concepts, schemes, and values, which had been based on the relation of the Creator to the creation, but to reformulate them within the prevailing two-term system of subject and object, ego and non-ego, the human mind or human consciousness and its transactions with nature. Once established, this narrative of secularization and the rise of unbelief, seen as either loss or gain, leads to a series of correlative conclusions about what Paul Ricoeur has memorably termed the conflict of interpretations. With this phrase, Ricoeur refers to the proliferation of explanatory models for interpreting human behavior, for assessing the sweep of history, and for deciphering texts that have accompanied the emergence of open unbelief in the second half of the 19th century and in the 20th century. Ricoeur employs this term, the conflict of interpretations, most specifically to describe the work of those he calls the masters of suspicion: Karl Marx, Friedrich Nietzsche, and Sigmund Freud. Each of these figures put forward a comprehensive and a compelling reinterpretation of history, human actions, and texts. Theirs were master narratives that sharply questioned the specifically Christian and generically providential accounts that had come before them. Their narratives, along with Darwin's account of natural selection, also called each other into question as they vied for supreme explanatory power. So what Ricoeur is arguing is that in the second half of the 19th century, there arose what he calls the hermeneutics of suspicion. And Freud, Marx, Nietzsche — he does not deal with Darwin, but surely Darwin would fit in this scheme — all came forward with what they took to be, and what many found to be, compelling models to explain not just human behavior, but the whole of human history and the way in which one would read human texts, human artifacts. And these competing schemes, in a sense, filled in the gap that the loss of providential history seemed to leave. And they were not only vying with that narrative of providential history, but they began to clash with one another. In its broader sense, however, this term, the conflict of interpretations, has come to stand for the more general phenomenon of interpretive competition in modernity. Think of this fact, that the past 5 centuries have been marked by an unprecedented and ever-accelerating flow of persons and information across national and cultural borders. If you're old enough to do this — this will take a stretch of imagination for anybody under the age of, 25 or 30. Imagine when we received mail once a day and had one telephone without caller ID or an answering machine. And we got a newspaper, and we maybe had a radio and a television. Okay, that's still a lot of time, but okay, that's it. I now have, counting my office, my work, I have 4 different phones at which I can be reached, a fax number, 3 email accounts. I pick up mail in 5 different places. I have the internet. I have DVDs. I have VHSs. I have a television. I have cable television. I'm not that unusual. Think of the way in which we have become individually, in a sense, we're kind of like transoms over which information flows. We have become. And this is simply an acceleration of the flow of information that's been taking place for centuries, for at least 400 to 500 years, the last 4 to 5 centuries, this flow of information, the ever-accelerating flow of persons, too, in the jostle of individuals and ideas, long-established beliefs and customs have been thrown into constant contact and occasional conflict with one another. At times, these conflicts assume the roles assigned to them in the grand secularization narratives of modernity, as ancient beliefs clash with modern discoveries. Frequently, however, the conflict of interpretations appears as a struggle between contemporary versions, contemporary visions, each of which can claim its limited validity. In this mode, the conflict frequently becomes a part of the internalized dynamic of the struggle of belief and unbelief. More than 2 decades ago, Jeffrey Stout gave a very useful name to this development. He called it the problem of many authorities. To Stout, one of early modernity's most important characteristics was a rapid multiplication and wide divergence of claims to religious authority. As interpretive schemes and ecclesiastical bodies proliferated in and after the Reformation, Stout writes, conventional means for resolving disputes arising for such competition became less and less effective. In turn, the problem of many authorities became the central social and intellectual difficulty of the Reformation. The doctrine of sola scriptura, scripture alone, gave many Protestants and Protestant traditions a regulative ideal for their faith, but it did not do away with the interpretive conflicts that rage across and over the scriptures to this day. One scripture, many interpretations. Any who doubt this to be the case need to know nothing more than examine the recent history of conflicts, and by recent I mean last several centuries, of conflicts over the interpretation of just a mere six words spoken by Jesus on the last night of his life. Take, eat, this is my body. Now, there's been a lot of disagreement over what that means, and there continues to be a lot of disagreement over what that means. This is what Stout calls the problem of many authorities, the problem, one of the central problems of modernity. Herman Melville made the conflict of interpretations, understood as a struggle between competing visions, a main subject of Moby Dick. The most serious conflict in the novel arises between Captain Ahab's spiritual and intellectual obsession with the whale and the many reasons the other sailors have for undertaking the voyage. Ahab's shipmates have signed on to the voyage to see the world, to kill whales, and to make a decent living. He cares for none of these things and seeks instead only vengeance on a dumb brute. In the novel's most pointed exploration of the conflict of interpretations, each of the main characters pauses before a gold coin that is nailed to the mast and offered by Ahab as a reward to the first sailor to spot the great white whale. Each of the main characters of the novel walks by the coin one morning and interprets the meaning of the three Andes peaks rendered on the coin. When they have all finished with their readings, it falls to Pip, the crazed cabin boy who serves as a kind of court jester to the overbearingly regal Captain Ahab. Having heard their separate and wildly conflicting interpretations, Pip simply three times conjugates the verb to look. I look, you look, he looks, we look, ye look, they look. Says it three times. That's all he says. Or as the ship's mate Flask puts the matter, there's another rendering now, but still one text. All sorts of men in one kind of world. Melville was primarily and particularly interested in the case of Captain Ahab, in whom all possibilities meet and clash, all sorts of ideas in one kind of man, one consciousness. And this is the key to my argument. Melville and Dickinson considered the conflict of interpretations more a matter of internal struggle than an issue of primarily public dispute. In the dynamics of belief, they intuited remarkable developments that it would take later generations to articulate more fully. Looking back a century, Charles Taylor identified this change as the discovery by the modern subject that it contains within itself an inexhaustible inner domain. In a manner unique in the history of culture and ideas, what Taylor terms the modern post-expressivist subject has become aware of itself as possessing inner depths. We can explore those depths, but we can never exhaust their resources. In Taylor's words, the inescapable feeling of depth comes from the realization that whatever we bring up, there is always more down there. And in Melville and in Dickinson and a host of other key Christian and non-Christian writers of the last 150 years, there has been this intense awareness of these inner depths and an awareness of the forces that reside in tension within those depths. This tension drove Melville to the Holy Lands in search of rest and resolution, and it's propelled much of the greatest poetry and fiction of the past 150 years. Further, the emergence and internalization of unbelief has had profound consequences for personal spiritual experience, as well as for the development of Christian theology and the engagement of Christian thought with contemporary culture. The issues at stake here are ultimately the stuff of books and multi-volume systematic theologies. Having identified, however, a new dynamic of the internalized struggle of belief and unbelief that appeared in the 19th century, I'd like now to turn the rest of my time and our attention to one of what we, in the parlance of today, would call the first responders on the scene. And one of the first responders on this scene in the 19th century was the great novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky. And I want to look at Dostoevsky with you and to supplement our look at Dostoevsky with an examination of what is probably the person who may be his greatest of all interpreters, Mikhail Bakhtin. With the assistance of the incomparable 19th century novelist and the brilliant 20th century theorist, we can see how two profound Christian thinkers have wrestled with the implications of modern unbelief and with the conflict of interpretations. You see, for Dostoevsky, the internalization of the struggle between belief and unbelief profoundly altered his personal life and his fictional methods. This is nowhere more evident than in the events leading up to the writing of his last and greatest novel, The Brothers Karamazov, and in the pages of that novel itself. As his biographer Joseph Frank explains, Dostoevsky came to the writing of The Brothers Karamazov filled with anxiety over what he considered to be the breakdown of the Russian family. Frank writes that that breakdown was for Dostoevsky only the symptom of a deeper underlying problem, the loss of firmly rooted moral values among educated Russians stemming from their loss of faith in Christ and God. In turn, Dostoevsky took that loss of faith to have been created by the ascendancy of philosophical rationalism and scientific materialism in 19th century Europe in general, and in Russia in particular. This set the stage, in Frank's words, for the Brothers Karamazov to explore the conflict between reason and faith, faith now being understood very sharply as the irrational core of the Christian commitment. It's the genius of this novel, however, not to represent this conflict primarily as a battle between starkly different persons holding radically opposing viewpoints. Instead, Dostoevsky sets the battle within the mind and heart of each main character. The eldest brother, Dmitri, puts the matter so well and so compellingly to his younger brother, Alyosha, early in the novel. This is what Dmitri says. He says to Alyosha, he says, I can't bear it. I can't bear it that some man, even with a lofty heart and the highest mind, should start from the ideal of the Madonna and end with the ideal of Sodom. Dmitri finds it even more fearful that someone who already has the ideal of Sodom in his soul does not deny the ideal of the Madonna either, and his heart burns with it. The problem with human beings, Dmitri reluctantly concludes, is that they have too much range within their hearts and within their minds. No, man is broad, too broad, he complains. I would narrow him down. Here, the devil is struggling with God, and the battlefield is the human heart. In myriad ways, each of the main characters in the Brothers Karamazov, the brothers, their father, the Russian Orthodox elders, Osima, must bear this burden of the breadth of the human heart. As the events of the novel unfold, Dostoevsky is fascinated by the vast, complex inner agitations of his own characters, in each of whom the struggle between belief and unbelief continues. The torment is almost unbearably intense in Ivan, the middle brother, who attempts simultaneously to deny the existence of God and human virtue and to promote the ideal of radical personal and social justice. And if you've read the novel, you know that Ivan says two things so powerfully. One, he says that if God does not exist, then there is no heaven and hell. And if there is no heaven and hell, then there is no basis for human ethics. because there is no eternal system of rewards and punishments. Yvonne says, there is nothing in the human heart to make a man or a woman love a neighbor. Ethics must come from the fear of punishment and the hope of rewards. And if there is no heaven or hell, there is no standard of good and evil. And if there is no standard of good and evil, all things are permitted. He holds to that position at the same time he holds to a utopian dream that he might be instrumental in bringing about nothing less than a revolution in the social order. And it's an absolutely gripping and devastating passage in the Brothers Karamazov. Dostoevsky takes from the papers and newspapers and journals of Russia in the 1870s episodes of the abuse of children. And these are episodes that you and I could find in the papers of Atlanta, Chicago, Cleveland, or Chattanooga any day of the week. They are not something that you would have to invent. They are episodes about the enormous and brutal mistreatment of children. And Ivan Karamazov says to his brother Alyosha, all things may be permitted, but I also must create a world in which innocent children do not suffer. And I reject God's creation, I reject God's system, because if there is a God, he has permitted this kind of suffering. Father Zosima, the elder at the monastery, recognizes how that would be a really tormenting vision. And when he meets Ivan, he tells him that you must be most unhappy. Ivan says, what do you mean? The elder then explains, this whole idea is not resolved in your heart. And it torments you. For the time being, you are toying out of despair with your magazine articles and your drawing room discussions without believing in your own theories. And you are smirking at them with your aching heart inside you. The question is not resolved in you. And there lies your great grief, for it urgently demands resolution. Neither, however, are the questions entirely resolved for the eager, pious Alyosha in the novel's opening scenes. He is torn between his devotion to his elder and the spiritual order of Russian Orthodoxy and his sympathy for the erratic, wayward, and passionate souls he must deal with, especially his own family. After he lays out his brief against God and any idea of a divinely sanctioned moral order, Ivan presses this impressionable young Alyosha on a key theological point. When Alyosha calls Ivan's attack upon Christian ethics an act of rebellion, the older brother sets a challenge for the younger one. Imagine, Ivan says, imagine that you have created human beings with the goal of their everlasting blessedness in mind. In order to create that final harmony of peace and rest, however, quote, you must torture just one tiny creature, and raise your edifice on the foundation of her unrequited tears. Would you agree to be the architect on such conditions? Ivan asks. No, I would not agree, is all that Alyosha can reply, meekly. Later in the novel, both Alyosha and Ivan undergo crises of faith and doubt. Alyosha wins through to a deepened spiritual commitment in the wake of Father Zosima's death. Ivan, on the other hand, is like Oedipus Rex, in that he must be brought reluctantly through great suffering to an act of self-understanding that includes the acknowledgement of his responsibility for the murder of his own father. The novel concludes with Alyosha confident in his assertions about the resurrection of the dead and committed to a ministry of reconciliation among the young boys of his community. Yet at the same time, Dostoevsky leaves the fate of Ivan uncertain. God will win, Alyosha assures himself regarding Ivan's destiny. Yet at the same time, he knows his brother's fate and future are still open. Ivan will either rise into the light of truth or perish in hatred, taking revenge on himself and everyone for having served something he does not believe in. Mikhail Bakhtin found in Ivan's uncertain, wavering state, and in a multitude of other instances, evidence of Dostoevsky's revolutionary genius as a practitioner of the novel and as a theoretician of human understanding. And I should just say as an aside that if you're ever discouraged and think, is there somebody who needs to address a problem? And if you are a Christian, you say, where is a Christian thinker is addressing a problem? All of us young and old who were laboring away in the West for so many years working on things had no idea that in Stalinist and post-Stalinist Russia, one of the great literary theorists of the 20th century was working out of the Christian tradition and with the texts of Dostoevsky on problems that many of his compatriots worked on all over the world, unknowing, not having any idea of who he was. Bakhtin died in 1975, and since his death and the publication of his works, his star has ascended and continues to ascend. He's very high up there in the theoretical heavens, and I think he belongs there. And he's also a tremendous resource for Christian thinking about contemporary life and the interpretation of life and texts. And it was in Dostoevsky's fiction that Bakhtin discovered the origins of what he would famously term the polyphonic novel. Bakhtin said that Dostoevsky invented a new kind of novel, a new genre. And in that novel, Bakhtin thought he had found the resources to incorporate, needed to incorporate the conflict of interpretations within a renewed Christian understanding of the truth. Now, that's a very tall order. But Bakhtin thought that Dostoevsky, and he thought that he, was up to the task. In Bakhtin's reading of intellectual history, Dostoevsky in the late 19th century developed what he, Bakhtin, calls the polyphonic novel to break the stranglehold of monologic thought upon the modern mind and heart. In a monologic world, writes Bakhtin, an idea belongs to no one, and the hero of a monologic work simply, quote, carries the independently valid idea assigned to him by the author. In a monologic artistic world, Bakhtin argues, there is no third way. A thought is either affirmed, it's true, or repudiated. It is either a matter of belief or unbelief. Otherwise, it simply refuses to be and ceases to be a fully valid thought. Bakhtin traces the roots of what he calls, and I admit this is not a very poetic term, monologism. He traces the roots of this to European rationalism with its cult of a unified and exclusive reason, and especially to the Enlightenment. These are his words. All of European utopianism, including, and he writes this in the midst of Stalinist, post-Stalinist Russia, including Marxism, was built on this monologic principle. This principle found its most suitable home in idealistic philosophy, writes Bakhtin, where the affirmation of the unity of existence, and I think that's a principle that's consonant with a belief in the unifying power of scriptural narrative, among other things. A belief in the unity of existence is transformed into a belief in the unity of the consciousness. According to Bakhtin, idealism takes this consciousness in general to be the dwelling place of truth, while individualized consciousnesses, the consciousness of the solitary person, for example, can only be considered to be locations and sites of error. For the monological point of view, truth abides in the unity of consciousness. Quote, there is no need for a multitude of consciousnesses, and there is no basis for it. I'll admit that Bakhtinian theory is abstract and complex stuff. Reading about the individualized consciousness in the monological point of view and the affirmation of the unity of existence is enough to drive a person back to what, and I remember this because it was, I think it was a Dell paperback, to what a 1960s Abridged version had trumpeted on its cover, the Abridged version of the Brothers Karamazov trumpeted as Dostoevsky's classic tale of lust and murder. And you think, well, after all this monologism and individualist consciousness, where's the lust and murder? Yet, Bakhtin has a point, and he makes a point out of this lust and murder, a profoundly important point in his account of the interplay of the novel, modern consciousness, and the Christian faith. He takes the depiction of characters in fiction, Bakhtin does, to be indicative of the limits of modern philosophy's view of the individual and the truth. In both, according to Bakhtin, in both the conventional novel and post-Cartesian philosophy, fixed and unified ideas take precedence over changing and complex beliefs, just as consciousness is seen to be superior to existence. Characters in monologic novels have the ideas of the authors, quote, placed in their mouths, and those ideas have no living relationship to the vagaries of the character's personality or the vicissitudes of a character's life. In like manner, modern rationalism and utopian socialism, according to Bakhtin, both also operate on this monologic principle, the omnipotence of the conviction. Fixed ideas and utopian goals override all personal, limited, and particular realities. Though Bakhtin doesn't draw this connection, there are unmistakable links between the views he attacks as monological and the ancient Christian heresy of Docetism. The Docetics of the early church sought to deny the humanity of Jesus, and they sought to protect his divinity by claiming, in effect, that in the incarnation, God more or less borrowed a body into which to pour the pure and unsullied divine spirit. The agony in the Garden of Gethsemane, the suffering on the cross, the cry of dereliction, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Those were the experiences of the human Jesus and not of the divine Christ. In docetic Christology, as in monologic theory, that which is eternal, timeless, and universal retains its perfection by never being dragged into time or wedded to the body. According to Bakhtin, monologism retains its appeal because it has become the default theory for understanding truth in the modern world. The truth must be single, it must be unified and transcendent, monologism holds. But it is precisely this assertion that Bakhtin challenges directly. And this is the only passage I've quoted any length, and it's just several sentences from a book called The Problems of Dostoevsky's Poetics. It's a good passage, though. It should be pointed out that the single and unified consciousness is by no means an inevitable consequence of the concept of a unified truth. It's quite possible to imagine and to postulate a unified truth that requires a plurality of consciousnesses, one that cannot in principle be fitted into the bounds of a single consciousness, one that is, so to speak, by its very nature, full of eventful potential and is born at a point of contact among various consciousnesses. The monologic way arises only where consciousness is placed above existence and where the unity of existence is transformed into the unity of consciousness. In a monologic world, writes Bakhtin, both the genuine interaction of consciousnesses and genuine dialogue are impossible. They become possible only in a fictional or actual realm in which the plurality of human voices and the internal divisions of the individual consciousness are taken not as roadblocks to the truth, but as avenues to it. The closing sentence of the Dostoevsky book presents its readers with a charge that is, in the narrow sense, a call to aesthetic renewal, but which stands in the end as a call to theoretical and to theological renewal. We must renounce our monologic habits so that we might come to feel at home in the new artistic sphere which Dostoevsky discovered, so that we might orient ourselves in that incomparably more complex artistic model of the world which he created. What is at the core of that complex model of the world? It's the polyphonic model of discourse. This term has had a remarkably complicated and influential history in the past several decades, but Bakhtin never gave an explicit, exhaustive definition of it. Perhaps his fullest explanation of the term comes in the opening pages of that book on Dostoevsky. These are his words. A plurality of independent and unmerged voices and consciousnesses, a genuine polyphony of fully valid voices, is in fact the chief characteristic of Dostoevsky's novels. Instead of a single authorial consciousness, Dostoevsky presents us with a world peopled by a plurality of consciousnesses, each with equal rights and each with its own world. The heroes of Dostoevsky's fiction are not only objects of the author's discourse, but they are also subjects of their own directly signifying discourse. In a traditional model of novelistic discourse, the power to mean belongs to the author alone. in a polyphonic novel, multiple voices share and exercise this power. And what does this mean? Two brief asides. First of all, when I think of this term polyphony, it occurred to me after I wrote this paper, just coming down here on Saturday, it occurred that I might constructively have added to this a remarkably beautiful and profound meditation on the question of polyphony in the letters that Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote from prison in Berlin in 1943, 44, and, well, very early 1945. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Lutheran pastor who refused to stay in America in safety because he felt that if he did not share in the suffering of Germany, he could not share in her rebuilding. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was reluctantly brought against his pacifist convictions into a plot to kill Hitler, and who was arrested in 1943, and who was hanged about three and a half weeks before VE Day. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was engaged to be married but knew in the prison that he would probably never be married, nevertheless wrote some extraordinarily beautiful and passionate letters about the goodness of ordinary life. And in several of them, Bonhoeffer calls for what he calls a polyphony in the Christian experience. He says, the love of God is the cantus firmus that gives the melodic line, the strong main line of Christian experience. But earthly affections provide the polyphony, the varied voices. He says, we honor God most fully by finding Him not only in the pages of the Scriptures, but also in the goodness of the life that He has given us. He said, for a man to be hankering after God while he is in the arms of his wife, is not only in bad taste, but it's also bad theology. And Bonhoeffer writes so compellingly of the goodness of ordinary experience and of the need for ordinary experience to provide part of the polyphony of the understanding of the Christian life. And the other thing I would say about the meaning of this term polyphony, and what Bakhtin's trying to get at here, as if any of you have ever read the Brothers Karamazov, you may have had the experience I had the first two times I read it. I thought Ivan Karamazov won the argument. Ivan Karamazov wins the argument, and I want Alyosha, and then Jesus appears in the novel, and I want Jesus to beat Ivan, to be a better philosopher. And when Ivan accuses, through a character he creates, accuses Jesus and indicts him, what does Jesus do? He responds silently with a kiss. And I read that and I said, this just doesn't compute. And Dostoevsky had taken the risk to make the character of Ivan so compelling and in a sense so strong that many who read the novel might find him more compelling than Alyosha, whom Dostoevsky calls in the first sentence of the novel his hero. But Bakhtin says Dostoevsky knew he must take this risk. In a polyphonic novel, multiple voices share and exercise the power of meaning. By surrendering his monologic powers, Gary Saul Morrison and Carol Emerson claim in their fine study of Bakhtin, Dostoevsky created a way to embody a dialogic conception of truth. Morrison and Emerson are quick to point out, however, that for Bakhtin, there's a vast difference between a truth that is contradictory or ambiguous and one that requires two or more voices. In the case of the Brothers Karamazov, this means that while Dostoevsky may call Alyosha his hero, he refuses to rein in or close off the powerful opposing discourse of Ivan. Bakhtin claims that Dostoevsky puts himself and his readers directly at risk by allowing Ivan's arguments to develop as persuasively as they do. More than one, Bakhtin takes Dostoevsky the author to would of necessity include within itself a correlative possibility of unbelief. They understood that the way to truth would be through the dialogical struggle of the conflict of interpretations, through the soul's sometimes hostile, often humble opposition of its to itself and to God. Thank you. Thank you, and I really welcome questions. I I'd like to make eye contact, and I tried, but I know you're out there.
I can hear you. So I'll show you. See, anybody with questions, comments? Yes.
Karamazov. It's the brothers Karamazov, right. Yes. Oh, I see you better and better now. Yes. Anyone else with a question? Question here. Yes, sir.
No. I don't think it has been that thoroughgoing. I don't think it's been. It's been significant, but not thoroughgoing. It has been significant, but not thoroughgoing. Do you want to follow? I mean, maybe I'm not asking.
A naive assumption of relativism. Well, give me a little bit more about what's behind your question. Monologic versus relativism.
Well, yeah. In trumpeting some of the benefits of plurality of voices,
right.
It seems some of the vices have almost severed the ability.
Well, I would not consider myself as trumpeting the value so much of the plurality of voices as acknowledging the reality of these things.
I think the reality of human experience is in the modern world is that one is, whether one likes it or not, approves it or not, one is involved in a constant kind of to and fro of value systems and belief systems. I find this to be a reality that is given to me in the place in which God has placed me in history. And then the question is how I respond to this. This opposition of monologic and relativist, of single and relativist, I think that that's probably been one of the less fruitful kind of diametrical oppositions of contemporary Christian thought, that a humble belief in one's inability to comprehend the whole of the truth, and in a humble belief in one's need to have other people to correct one's and to challenge one, and sometimes to supplement what one understands, is not the same thing as a belief that all things are possible and all things are permitted. Without question, the idea of all things being permitted and all things being possible is a powerful and problematic in the modern world. But I think that that's a problematic that comes to us less from the influence of interpretive theories and much more from the rise of conceptions of the human person. And I'll give you one really quick example. Less than 3 years after he wrote Moby Dick, Herman Melville wrote one of the great short stories in the English language, which doesn't read anything like Moby Dick. It's called Bartleby the Scrivener. And if you've ever read the stories about a fellow who's hired as a law clerk in a law office on Wall Street, the problem with this law clerk, he's supposed to copy deeds and wills and probate. The problem with this law clerk is that he won't do anything. And the only thing he will ever say to his boss when asked to do something is, "I would prefer not to." And he says that about everything, and he says it down to the boss's most elemental requests about his background. Any question, he said, "I prefer not to answer that. I prefer not to." And what I think Melville uncannily gets to there is, in a sense, our modern moral world—a world in which we understand the kind of the relativizing of discourse and values to consist of the reduction of all moral questions to questions of preference that are decided on personal bases and cannot be argued. They can only be managed. And that one cannot question the preferences of another and one cannot infringe upon them. And this is, in a sense, this to me is the far more powerful agent of relativizing in the modern world, kind of an ethical and cultural situating of the self rather than it being the product of theories of interpretation. But I'll follow up on that. Anybody else with a question? Anybody else? Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Not for Dostoevsky. The novel ends, if you've read the novel, some people feel it's unfair. Ivan's a mess. And I think it's absolutely compelling. The story of Ivan is the modern retelling of the Oedipus Rex story, where a man has to vow that he vows that the one thing he will never kill his father, and he finds out that he did. It's very subtly done, but I mean that's yeah. And Ivan's a mess, and Alyosha is ascended and triumphant. Had Dostoevsky lived, he planned a sequel in which he was going to show Alyosha's Christian reconciling mission among young boys in Russia. That was the sequel to the Brothers Karamazov. He died within months of the publication of the novel, didn't finish it. So Alyosha's voice clearly and openly represents Dostoevsky's. But Dostoevsky says to Alyosha, Bakhtin's theory is that Dostoevsky allows a latitude to other characters that is very, very uncommon. And Bakhtin says that in the history of the reception of that novel, many people have found Ivan to be the more convincing character. Although Dostoevsky clearly aligns himself with one character and planned a sequel in which he proved this even more forcefully. I think the analogy, one analogy here that works very nicely is the way one thinks about raising one's children. And you think about that. You think about the question of freedom. And how when one raises one's children, the way I put it, by sometime between the age of 18 and 21, you give them up to God, their own freedom in the world. And the most you can do with them is to guide them when they ask and to suffer with them when they need. But you cannot in any way control the narratives of their lives. And sometimes you recognize the fact that you cannot possibly determine the shape of their lives. And I find in Bakhtin's understanding of Dostoevsky's writing of the novel, my own understanding of parenting, I find analogs to the Christian Gospels account of a God who became flesh and dwelt among us. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and suffered with and on our behalf. And I find in the understanding of the Incarnation remarkable analogs to what Bakhtin discusses in terms of Dostoevsky's willingness to let his characters thwart his purposes, which would be my way of speaking of what Christians try to mean when they speak of the doctrine of the fall. But, you know, okay. Other hands. Yes, a hand up there. Yes. Yes. Well, you know, what becomes the basis? And it really is a question. It's a question of what one personally holds to be ultimate truth, what one believes, and also what one understands about one's place in a community. What do I mean by that? I struggled in my early years of Christian profession with the fact that I lived in the modern world and in democratic order. I had fantasies about the Middle Ages. And I really thought I'd wanted to live in the Middle Ages. And my headmaster at the master school, we were at a play at the Hartford Stage Company, and I'm a young 23-year-old, I don't know, hotshot erstwhile medievalist. And I say to my headmaster, Ralph Mattson, I say, Ralph, I'd like to have lived in the Middle Ages. He said, oh, you do, before Novocaine. Aha! Before penicillin, aha! And immediately I recognized, when I was 6 weeks old, I had a life-saving operation for a very rare condition called pyloric stenosis. Had I not had that surgery, I would have been dead. At the age of 8, I was within hours of death from pneumonia. I was saved by penicillin. I thought, oh yeah, it would have been great for me to have lived in the Middle Ages. I would have been dead twice by the age of 10, but I certainly would have enjoyed it. And for me, it comes to the question of then accepting my place in a democratic world, the basis for plurality of voices. I accept the democratic reality of America, the freedom of religion, the freedom of political and religious expression. And that means that I, in my position of commitment and conviction and practice, will constantly be in contact with and engaged with people of widely divergent points of view. Now, I know the basis of my own voice. I don't understand it fully. I understand it adequately. I understand it through the way I worship, the way I live in my family, the way I work as a scholar and as a teacher.
But I also recognize that I recognize the inevitable contact I have with many, many different voices. So the basis for this community has often a lot to do with the disposition I display, my willingness to engage people, and it also has to do with the reality of the fact that I come into contact with an extraordinarily diverse number of people, if not on a daily basis, pretty regularly. Yeah. Yes. Nietzsche's idea is an intersubjectivity. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I theologically, I'm not at the same point as Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky, I mean, I had theological disagreements with him. I am not as much of an irrationalist in my understanding of the Christian faith as Dostoevsky is. But I think where Dostoevsky and Nietzsche would disagree, and Bakhtin definitely would disagree with Nietzsche, is that ultimately Nietzsche believes he has the compelling explanation with the theory of the will to power. And perspectivalism allows for a multitude of different perspectives in Nietzschean thought, but the base assumption allows for very little diversity, I believe. Now, I mean, I'm of a mind that Nietzsche takes kind of a material explanation of the universe to be a given, and then understands consciousness is this painful accident that must react to and interact with this given, and his perspectivalism comes out of that awareness in him, so that for him, it's the will to power is the unifying, this kind of the unifying discourse. Whereas Bakhtin's understanding of Dostoevsky involves a respect for the other. And we can have disagreements about this. I mean, and this is a disagreement in Nietzsche studies. I do not find Nietzsche having the capacity to respect and enter into dialogue with the other. I find the dynamic of power and violence too strong in Nietzsche. So I think at the fundamental level where they would disagree is that Bakhtin would say that Dostoevsky, in his Christian belief, has an understanding of these other possibilities that makes him open to them in kind of commerce with them, whereas I think in a very fundamental way there's a much greater degree of certainty in Nietzsche. I'll conclude with this thought. I can say with complete confidence that Nietzsche from, I don't know exactly what, let's say the 1870, 1874 on, Nietzsche never in his waking moments ever considered the possibility of Christian belief seriously in the way that Dostoevsky, in his deep Christian belief, considered the possibility of unbelief seriously. That I can say confidently. Yeah. Other questions? Yes. Well, this is the great question, and I would say ultimately, I would say the sovereignty of God directs that. That's a punt of an answer, though, to the question you're asking. And when we get to this question, what we're really acknowledging is that when we speak of what regulates it, we're saying what is the authority. And in Christian terms, this comes to debates about the adjudicating the authority between Scripture and tradition, obviously. Most Protestants placing a greater emphasis upon Scripture, Eastern Orthodoxy and Catholicism placing an emphasis upon tradition, and both Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy have within them hierarchies and structures of power that have interpretive authority. Then the question becomes, who has the regulative authority? Protestants don't avoid this problem, because Protestants do not avoid the problem of someone having to adjudicate disputes about the interpretation of the Scripture. I went to an evangelical Protestant seminary, and my people in New Testament thought they had the historical critical method that gave them the definitive take on Scripture. And I studied with systematic people who were convinced that their Christian brothers in New Testament had no idea of what was the regulating authority. And I think this question is really one of the key questions for Christian belief and Christian practice, Christian profession. How does one understand authority, and where does one place the authority to adjudicate disputes in among this plurality of voices? For me, it is a complex combination of my personal experience, my belief in the authority of the Scriptures, and my understanding of the vital role played by the life of the Church and the history of the Christian tradition. One of my primary concerns in thinking about all these things is to acknowledge the fact that I, as a Protestant, do not, by virtue of being a Protestant, solve the problem of authority. I said that, and I think a couple of you laughed. I thank you for that. But I said, "This is my body." What were the six words I had? "This is my body. Take." I'm trying to remember the translation I had. "Take, eat. This is my body." And it may even sound facetious, but when I think about it, very conservative Protestant Christians powerfully disagree about what that means. I witnessed a scuffle in the narthex sort of the library classroom at the Gordon Conwell Library over the difference between transubstantiation and consubstantiation. Two seminarians who I knew all but threw their fists at each other over this fact. And is it not an acknowledged fact of Christian history that we have not come to a definitive determination of what Jesus meant in those six words? So to say that the Scripture is the final authority, yes, fine, but that still does not do away with this problem of interpretive authority. And that's a question that we ask in answer in different ways, do we not? Yes. Well, thank you. Okay. Oh, very good. Yeah. I thought you really liked that point.